In 1993, when President Clinton gave a speech about his health care plan to both houses of Congress, most Republicans were not pleased. But one Republican was ecstatic. His name was Richard Nixon. Caris Wofford was a civil rights advisor for John F. Kennedy, who helped to shape the civil rights bill tried to pass. But he's best known, perhaps, for his actions 30 years later, when Pennsylvania Senator John Hines died. Governor Bob Casey of Pennsylvania, a Democrat, set off, which is always an interesting event in American politics, when he appointed the Democratic Wofford to the Republican Senate seat of John Hines. Wofford would face the two-term governor of the state and Bush Attorney General Dick Thornburgh. It seemed pretty likely the Republicans were going to win back what would be a Republican seat. Dick Thornburgh was well known in Pennsylvania. He was 20 points ahead in the polls. As Democratic consultant and advisor and then campaign manager Paul Begala tells it, and this race would get Begala and his friend Jim Carville noticed by a certain Arkansan running for president. As Begala tells it, they sent Harris Wofford to a meeting of ophthalmologists. "Please," they said, "we need money. Get some money." When Wofford came back, Begala asked him, "How much money did you raise?" "No money at all," Wofford said, disappointing Begala. "But an idea." Begala rolled his eyes. It was money they needed to keep the campaign going. Well, Wofford said, one of the ophthalmologists had come up to him after the meeting and said, "You know, Harris, lawyers made the Constitution, and they gave everyone a right to see a lawyer if they couldn't afford one. If it were my forefathers, the doctors, and not your forefathers, the lawyers who made the Constitution, it would say you would have the right to see a doctor if you couldn't afford one, instead of just a lawyer." The way Begala tells it, he got over his frustration with the money that Wofford didn't raise and began to take up the ophthalmologist's idea. He began a simple campaign theme based on the concept that every person should have health insurance. All they could afford in the campaign were short ads, and so that's what they used. And this fits in to the campaign style of Begala and Carville, who like a laser beam focus in their campaigns. The short ads would feature Harris Wofford looking directly at the camera, saying, "I'm Harris Wofford. As a senator, I have health care for me and my family. I've introduced a bill that says none of us should have health care until every other American does." The short ad ran again and again. Wofford didn't talk about anything else. Eventually, as he was closing the gap and the campaign could raise some more money, they made ads about Wofford's biography and pictures of him with as an advisor to Kennedy, etc. In 1991, he beat Thornburgh and beat him in many traditional Republican areas in Pennsylvania. The message was heard not just in Pennsylvania, but in other parts of the country. Bill Clinton would note the power of the issue and introduce health care as part of his presidential campaign the next year. He would begin a health care effort as president, one that it turned out didn't fly. Wofford himself was defeated in 1994. Bill Clinton, Max Baucus, and most healthcare reformers never quite adopted Wofford's message. It was missed, and still missed today. Policy wonks may think that they are getting at what moved a state's voters in such a huge swath by attempting to build a reform healthcare system, but I don't think they're getting it. Wofford's appealing message had not only to do with healthcare, but also with privilege. As a member of Congress, he got healthcare. Why shouldn't Americans? One could argue that this is still from a policy perspective. One could argue that this is silly, of course, from a policy perspective. Just as it's silly to go after congressional salaries, unless they got excessively big. That Congress is an employer. Unless we want every member of Congress getting a job and not really taking time to listen to constituents or do the important work that they have to do, we ought to pay them and as their main employer, we have to give them health insurance. But politically speaking, it is a surefire message, one that's lost today, not part of the current healthcare message. One of the most compelling attacks on the healthcare reform bill, in fact, is, will members of Congress take this public government system that is discussed? Of course, it's a public option. Bills attempting to do that have been voted down in each committee that attempted it. Any bills have been made that have attempted to say every member of Congress must take this healthcare public option, and those efforts have been voted down. Healthcare reform suffers from a dearth of emotional footholds, as we discussed in a previous podcast, in my opinion. Children and seniors are removed from the debate already. They get healthcare through other sources. Children through school-aged children's healthcare program, and seniors through Medicare. So it is about the 47 million 19 to 64-year-olds. Not all that compelling of a group. Can be made to be compelling, but we don't really know these people or who they are. President has attempted to, you know, pull out some stories in his speeches and make these people individuals, and that helps. But it's still not the most compelling group, because this is the exact group where we think of people as individuals, still in control of themselves and not people that need to be taken care of. Tom Daschle, who might have been health czar in the Obama White House, offered a plan to put anyone who wanted into the federal employee system in his book. They might have been wise to follow that decision. In other words, everyone, members of Congress, members of the federal government, and now the United States, who wanted to do so, could get into the federal employee system. Without considering that privilege argument, it makes healthcare reform uphill, but not impossible. The biggest thing going for the plan is the support of President Obama, who has made solving the problem of the 47 million an absolute priority in his administration. He has been elusive about the actual legislation, but not about the goal. His persistence, I believe, will win out, and there will be some kind of plan, whatever the political consequences. It will likely turn out to be a hodgepodge of the various ideas. Another simple approach, echoing the ophthalmologist who spoke to Wofford, is the right to see a doctor. Do we have the right to see a doctor the way we have a right to get a lawyer? Now, this runs into some constitutional problems that we come at before. You have a right to see a lawyer because the government's doing something to you. The government could be prosecuting you. The government could be putting you in jail. And if you don't have the money to defend, that would be unfair. That's what they're saying, to not have someone provide a defense lawyer for you. So you have a right to see a lawyer. You don't have a right necessarily to see a lawyer if you're constructing a will or if you're buying a house, although many counties have some free legal services that are available to the poor. But it's not a mandated right that you can see a lawyer at all times, just when the government's doing something to you. While it's controversial, I have pointed out that using the ninth, the unfinished ninth, that says we have more rights than may be in the Constitution, to assert we have basic needs, and that the complex healthcare system and the involvement of government in the healthcare system, which in many cases makes it more expensive for individuals, raises prices for certain services, it's made it difficult for individuals to get health care and therefore have a right to see a doctor. All one has to do is look at their hospital bill and see what the real prices are versus what your insurance company might be paying. And as an individual having to pay those fees, you know, you've been priced out of the system. And to some extent, the government did that to you by their involvement. In the quest for policy, Harris Wofford's rhetorical talking point has been left on the table, and I think it's partially the reason that there is this kind of ambiguity about the message behind the healthcare plan. As a side note, to answer somewhat that ophthalmologist, he is wrong on one point. While the founders did have many lawyers among them, there were also merchants, there were also military men, and there were, in fact, doctors. Josiah Bartlett, Benjamin Rush, and Matthew Thornton were all signers of the Declaration, and they were physicians. In fact, Rush and Bartlett were innovative doctors at the time. They were trying the new, you know, fangled treatments in medicine at the time. So why not life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness and good health? Well, we could argue that putting in the word life, which, while it's may not guarantee free health care, kind of might come into play if you're at the door of an emergency room and can't afford the care. Putting that aside, a right to a doctor was probably not included, even with many physicians among the founding fathers, for lack of advanced health care at the time. There weren't enough doctors to create some kind of national system, and doctors had, in some cases, a limited effect on patients. It wasn't 100%. There were very few hospitals to speak of in the early nation, and hospital care is really where expenses were coming in. Doctors were more of a community function. Communities would have a doctor. It was taken care of that way. More about healthcare, but first a question from the Facebook site. Brett Miller writes, "Bruce, I was looking at the results of the 1960 election and saw that Harry F. Byrd received electoral votes from Mississippi and Alabama in the 1960 election. And was wondering, was something going on during that election that was hidden by the closeness of the Nixon-Kennedy race? Even Perot was not able to achieve any electoral votes, and Byrd got them." Okay, so Harry Byrd was one of a few significant conservative Democrats who were elected at the time of Roosevelt in the early 1930s. Byrd was a senator from Virginia, but grew to oppose the New Deal. And Byrd, along with Miller Tidings of Maryland and Pat McCarran of Nevada, formed kind of an opposition party within the Democratic Party that gave Franklin Roosevelt quite a bit of headaches. In 1960, Byrd received the votes of some electors who did not want to vote for Kennedy or Nixon, mostly on the civil rights issue. He received electors who were unpledged to any candidate in Mississippi and Alabama. Because they were unpledged electors, in other words, they ran on the ballot not under the Kennedy ticket, not under the Nixon ticket, but just as themselves, as unpledged electors, and won, they were free to vote for who they wanted. That's the way the Electoral College works. Now, Byrd also received a vote in Oklahoma, and that vote was from what we would call a faithless elector, someone who had run under the Nixon ticket, but cast his vote in the Electoral College for Harry F. Byrd. Although, as you note, Ross Perot did not get electoral votes, and Byrd did, I don't think that Byrd's feat is in this election in 1960 is any greater than Perot. In fact, Perot accomplished something incredible, really, despite the fact that he was somewhat erratic, his personality. Perot did better than any third-party candidate since Teddy Roosevelt, and he pulled votes from each of the major party candidates. He had an appealing message that many people could go for, and he received a significant number of votes from every state. Some states, Colorado and Maine, for instance, significant votes, and he came close to winning those states. Quitting and then running again, as he did in the 1992 election, did harm him. But in June 1992, with Ham Jordan, the Democrat, and Ed Rollins, the Republican consultants, running his campaign, there was an absolute opportunity. Perot was leading in the polls as a third-party candidate over an incumbent president and a likely Democratic frontrunner. In frustration, Bill Clinton had asked his campaign managers at one point, what's the use of even getting the Democratic nomination? Perot illustrated one thing that's very important and dates all the way back to a decision by the Founding Fathers. The Founding Fathers decide to make the presidential election a separate election. In other words, it's not a matter of, as it happens in other countries, say the United Kingdom, where you elect members of Parliament, or here, you know, if we elect a member of Congress and they decide who the leader's going to be. That's not how it works. The presidential election is a separate election. Therefore, any person, can take it in a year. It's not true of midterms. No party is going to spring up in 2 years and suddenly take over Congress. The organization you need to do that is incredible. Shouldn't say it would never happen, but it's very difficult. Usually incumbents win those congressional seats. But a presidential election with money, support, a well-organized campaign, and a meaningful message, you can go from nowhere to the White House. Now, is this a stretch? After all, the only example I have is perhaps the election of 1912, where Teddy Roosevelt bolted out of the Republican convention and formed his own party, and now the election of 1992, where Perot was leading in June of that year, but certainly didn't win the election. All I have are two examples of failures. Perot was probably emotionally incapable of taking the election because of his personality. But if that weren't so, and with his support, if you look at where voters were, they were looking for some alternative and clinging on to Perot as crazy and erratic as he was. Had he stayed in, and knowing that, you know, a winner creates more wins. So as he was leading in the polls, significant politicians, maybe governors from both parties, might have started to endorse him. He could build an organization. He had the money to do it. And just even with all his money, had he remained high in the polls over the course of the summer, he could do some significant fundraising as well. And Perot certainly changed policy, forcing President Clinton to abandon some of his grandiose plans and to work on fixing the deficit. One of those grandiose plans of Clinton was his health care plan. And towards the end of 1993, his first year in office, Clinton made a speech to Congress advocating for action on health care. He said many things. He said that if the Congress gave him a bill that didn't cover every American, he would take his pen and veto it. Something Congress would never do, since Congress wouldn't send him a plan at all, as it turned out. But yet at that moment, he had the audience. The speech got good reviews. Democrats liked the speech. Most Republicans didn't. But one Republican was ecstatic. Surprisingly, it was former President Nixon, as he told Monica Crowley, who would write many books about Richard Nixon and his opinions in his final years. Richard Nixon was moved by the speech, mostly because Clinton had mentioned him. "He mentioned my plan," he told Crowley. "He's the first president to mention me in a speech. Ford, Reagan, and Bush never did. It took a lot for him to do it, and it probably drove the critics crazy. It was a hell of a speech," Nixon said. "He brought the house down." Clinton did indeed mention Nixon. Nixon would tell Monica Crowley, "I've always been a liberal on health care. I lost two brothers to tuberculosis and an aunt to cancer." Nixon may have been a self-proclaimed liberal on health care, but his plan wasn't exactly liberal. And still, though, it was enough reform to attract cooperation from Democratic senators. Though Watergate would foil the plan, as would small business opposition. There were three main components to Nixon's plan, which he also unveiled in front of Congress. The strongest was that every employer must provide health insurance. However, Nixon would let them use a new device to manage costs. After all, the problem was you had insurance companies paying the bill, really in employers paying them and their premiums, and doctors and hospitals charging the insurance companies. There was an incentive to lower costs, and employer premiums kept rising. Nixon would let them use a new device called the HMO, Health Maintenance Organization, which would manage health care costs so that insurance companies wouldn't just pay for anything the doctors and hospitals submitted. So the first component, every employer must provide health insurance, no matter how small. This is more sweeping than many proposals that have been made since. The second component was that those who couldn't afford health care premiums would get assistance from the government. The key word was assistance. Government wouldn't pay for it, but they would pay a percentage based on the person's income. And the third was an improvement to Medicare, some of those improvements have been enacted. The Nixon plan had one thing missing from many of the proposals now. It didn't require that every American get health insurance. The requirement was on the employers. For the most part, that's always been a Democratic idea, an employer mandate versus an individual mandate. Nixon made a point of stressing in his health care plan that he was keeping it in the private sector. It was going to be based on insurance companies working with these HMOs and employers, and that it was voluntary. No one would be forced to get health care insurance. The Nixon plan crafted half because he did indeed seem to care about health care. He did have the personal connection, grew up poor. And even as a candidate early on in the 40s, advocated for national health insurance. But also to stave off Democratic plans, particularly Ted Kennedy, who he feared would run against him in 1972. It failed for two reasons. The opposition of business, then as is now. Small businesses and the AMA let Nixon know they weren't happy with his plan. He might have overcome that if he got some Democratic votes. But Ted Kennedy, before the 1972 election, was blocking any proposal. He called Nixon's plan health care for rich people. After the 72 election, however, Kennedy had a secret meeting with the White House and tried to iron out some of the differences on health care. Watergate would hit, and it was not to be. The timing for health care was bad. Except for the part of the legislation authorizing health maintenance organizations, HMO, which would be picked up on later in the 1980s. The Nixon health care plan was dead. But in a meeting in the White House that Richard Nixon would have with Bill and Hillary Clinton in 1993, Nixon had advised almost every president after them, except for Ford and Carter. Nixon had had meetings with Reagan and with Bush Sr. in the White House. But Clinton's meetings he saw as more meaningful. Clinton was actually listening to him. He didn't agree with Clinton's politics, but he was excited to be in the White House again. Hillary flattered Richard Nixon by saying, "Your health care plan was the best." It was a compliment that Nixon would remember for some and record to Crowley, writing her book, Nixon Off the Record. In Crowley's book, she also talked to Nixon about Eisenhower. And since in a previous podcast we talked about Eisenhower in terms of Nixon, I figured we'd talk about Nixon in terms of Eisenhower. Nixon thought Eisenhower was an interesting fellow, charming and warm socially, but tough. "He didn't endorse me," Nixon said, "until 1960, when he absolutely had to. Not the most loyal thing to do. But I suppose he was protecting himself." Nixon had a surprising view of Ronald Reagan. "He was the right president at the best time. But for all Reagan's talk about getting government off of our back and out of our wallets, his politics weren't very compassionate," Nixon told Crowley. "It was capitalism gone wild. Government has to help those who are truly needy. I'm not talking about those who abuse the system and collect welfare checks under 8 different names. But I do believe that they have a responsibility to give a temporary, very temporary, hand to those who need it." Interesting comments from Nixon. And I do find that the Monica Crowley books about Nixon, Nixon Off the Record, and Nixon in Winter are quite interesting if you want to learn a little bit about American politics. I want to thank you for listening. Website is myhistorycanbeatupyourpolitics.com. I'll always plug the archive. It's $9.99. You'll get myhistorycanbeatupyourpolitics.com. Also check us out on Facebook. Thank you for listening.